Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, I wanted to start with a couple stories that'll give us some insights into nutrition. The first one from nutritionfacts.org is why drinking diet soda makes you crave sugar. And this is a pretty good example of how when we do something that's unnatural, oftentimes it kind of fools our body and ends up not even necessarily being a net good. We're not really smarter than our body. We try to outsmart it a lot of times, but a lot of times it doesn't work. So here goes. Why drinking diet soda makes you crave sugar. The problem with artificial sweeteners is that a disconnect ultimately develops between the amount of sweetness the brain tastes and how much glucose or blood sugar ends up coming to the brain. The brain feels cheated and figures you have to eat more and more and more sweetness in order to get any calories out of it. So as a consequence, at the end of the day, your brain says, okay, at some point I need some glucose or blood sugar. I need it here. And then you eat an entire cake because nobody can hold out in the end. If people are given Sprite Zero, a zero-calorie soda, or unsweetened carbonated lemon-lime water, but aren't told which drink they're getting or what the study is about, when they are later offered a choice of M&Ms, spring water, or sugar-free gum, who do you think picks the M&Ms? Those who drank the artificially sweetened soda were nearly three times more likely to take the candy than those who consumed either the sugar-sweetened or unsweetened drinks. So it wasn't a matter of sweet versus non-sweet or calories versus no calories. There's something about non-caloric sweeteners that somehow tricks the brain. The researchers did another study on which everyone was given Oreos and were then asked how satisfied the cookies made them feel. Once again, those who drank the artificially sweetened Sprite Zero reported feeling less satisfied than those who drank the regular Sprite or the sparkling water. These results are consistent with recent brain imaging studies demonstrating that regular consumption of artificial sweeteners can alter the neural pathways responsible for the hedonic or pleasure response to food. Indeed, the only way to really prevent the problem, to break the addiction, is to go completely cold turkey and go off all sweeteners, artificial as well as fructose, table sugar, and high fructose corn syrup. Eventually, the brain resets itself and you don't crave it as much. We've always assumed the consumption of both sugar and artificial sweeteners may be changing our palates or taste preferences over time, increasing our desire for sweet foods. Unfortunately, the data on this were lacking until now. 20 people agreed to cut out all added sugars and artificial sweeteners for 2 weeks. Afterwards, 95% found that sweet foods and drinks tasted sweeter or too sweet, and said moving forward they would use less or even no sugar. What's more, most stopped craving sugar within the first week, after only 6 days. This suggests a 2-week sugar challenge, or even a 1-week challenge, may help to reset taste preferences and make consuming less or no sugar easier. Perhaps we should be recommending it to our patients. Eating fewer processed foods and choosing more real, whole, and plant-based foods make it easy to consume less sugar, or at least easier. Okay, next up, this from Conscien Health. Another nutrition-related story. This one, low carb or slow carbs? Fiber matters. In the midst of popular frenzy about low-carb diets, substantial evidence suggests a shift in focus to us. Research is suggesting that slow carbs might be a very good option. Soluble fiber slows the digestion of carbohydrates. It gives food a lower glycemic index, meaning it produces less of a spike in blood sugar. Fiber can also have helpful effects on gut microbes. So thus it makes sense that new studies are confirming fiber can be helpful for managing weight, also for reducing the risk of chronic diseases. Viscous fiber is a type of soluble fiber that forms a gel when it dissolves in the gut. In the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Elena Javanowski and colleagues have a new paper documenting the value of such fiber. They find it can help people lose weight, even without calorie restriction. The authors concluded, dietary viscous fiber modestly yet significantly improved body weight and other parameters of adiposity independently of calorie restriction. Alongside this paper, Mads Jorth and Arnie Ostrup suggest that this effect may be due to more than the effect of the fiber on glucose and insulin responses to food. Recent evidence suggests that most of the health effects observed in response to dietary fibers are mediated via the composition of the microbiota. In a series of systematic reviews and meta-analyses last year, Bostjan-Jatsky et al. Found broad implications for health outcomes. They published their findings in Lancet, where they wrote, "Clinical trials show significantly lower body weight, systolic blood pressure, and total cholesterol when comparing higher with lower intakes of dietary fiber. Risk reduction associated with the range of critical outcomes was greatest when daily intake of dietary fiber was between 25 grams and 29 grams. Dose response curves suggest that higher intakes of dietary fiber could confer even greater benefit to protect against cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, and colorectal and breast cancer. Similar findings for whole grain intake were observed. From all this, we have good reason to think that perhaps the quality of the carbs we eat is just as important as the quantity. Some of the energy that goes into chasing a low-carb diet might do more good if it went into slow carbs, meaning more soluble and viscous fiber." Now, this is interesting because this last study, they basically topped out their dose of dietary fiber around 25 to 30 grams, which is about double what the average American intake is, which is around 15 grams a day. But that's actually not a very high intake. If you look back in human history with the diets that people ate, you know, when people were eating a whole food, largely plant-based diet through most of human existence, I mean, 100 grams was not unusual. In fact, I would think that if you want the most simple technique, perhaps, to go on a diet, I might suggest a 50-gram fiber-a-day diet, because this basically moves you wholesale into whole plant foods and naturally limits the amount of animal foods, which aren't as healthy and also tend to be a lot fattier and have saturated fats versus unsaturated fats. Okay, next up, let's begin formally with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the wide world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from Stat News, FDA and NIH let clinical trial sponsors keep results secret, investigation shows. I've done a whole series of these recently about health organizations, research organizations, academic institutions who have not been very transparent or accountable. Okay, here we go. This story was originally published by Science. For 20 years, the U.S. government has urged companies, universities, other institutions that conduct clinical trials to record their results in a federal database so doctors and patients can see whether new treatments are safe and effective. Few trial sponsors have consistently done so, even after a 2007 law made posting mandatory for many trials registered in the database. In 2017, the National Institute of Health and the Food and Drug Administration tried again, enacting a long-awaited, quote, final rule to clarify the law's expectations and penalties for failing to disclose trial results. The rule took effect two full years ago. On January 18, 2018, giving trial sponsors ample time to comply, but a Science investigation shows that many still ignore the requirement, while federal officials do little or nothing to enforce the law. Science examined more than 4,700 trials whose results should have been posted on the NIH website clinicaltrials.gov under the 2017 rule. Reporting rates by Most large pharmaceutical companies and some universities have improved sharply, but performance by many other trial sponsors, including ironically NIH itself, was lackluster. These sponsors, typically either the institution conducting the trial or its funder, must deposit results and other data within 1 year of completing the trial. But of 184 sponsor organizations with at least five trials, due as of September 25, 2019, 30 companies, universities, or medical centers never met a single deadline. As of that date, those habitual violators had failed to report any results for 67% of their trials and averaged 268 days late for those and all trials that missed their deadlines. They included such eminent institutions as Harvard University-affiliated Boston Children's Hospital, the University of Minnesota, and Baylor College of Medicine, all among the top 50 recipients of NIH grants in 2019. The violations cover trials in virtually all fields of medicine, and the missing or late results offer potentially vital information for the most desperate patients. Contacted for comment, none of the institutions disputed the findings of this investigation. In all 4,768 trials, science checked, sponsors violated the reported law more than 55% of the time, and in hundreds of cases where the sponsors get credit for reporting trial results, they have yet to be made publicly posted because of quality lapses flagged by clinicaltrials.gov staff. Although the 2017 rule and official statements at the time promised aggressive enforcement and stiff penalties, neither NIH nor FDA has cracked down. FDA now says it won't brandish its big stick, penalties of up to $12,103 a day for failing to report a trial's result, until after the agency issues further, quote, guidance on how it will exercise that power. It has not set a date. NIH said at a 2016 briefing on the final rule that it would cut off grants to those who ignore the trial reporting requirements as authorized in the 2007 law, but so far has not done so. Okay, next, from Discover Magazine, putting air filters in classrooms could give student performance a serious boost. In late 2015, a gas leak sprung in a Los Angeles neighborhood, lasting several months and sparking a flash of public health concerns. After the gas company responsible placed air filters in every school classroom within 5 miles of the leak, New York University economics researcher Michael Gilrain wanted to explore whether improved air quality had any impact on student performance. In short, does better air lead to better test scores? In a working paper released earlier this month, The Economist revealed that somewhat surprising consequences of the leak and its aftermath. Student test scores actually improved, and not just by a little either. The study suggests that installing air filters in classrooms could boost test scores by the same amount as cutting class sizes by a third. For years, scientists have known that poor air quality is linked to health concerns like bronchitis and asthma. Yet recently, several studies have shown that indoor air pollution can harm cognition and academic performance too. The study suggests that installing air filters in more schools could give student achievements a serious lift at a relatively low cost. And because air quality tends to be worse in lower-income communities, Gilrain notes, investing in better air could raise test scores nationwide while shortening the socioeconomic performance gaps in public education. Okay, next up in a somewhat related story, this from Science Daily. Between 2005 and 2016, the shift away from coal saved an estimated 26,610 lives and 570 million bushels of crops. The decommissioning of coal-fired plants in the continental United States has reduced nearby pollution and its negative impacts on human health and crop yields, according to a new University of California San Diego study. The findings published in Nature Sustainability use the U.S. transition in recent years from coal towards natural gas for electric power generation to study the local impacts of coal-fired unit shutdowns. While the shift from coal to natural gas has reduced carbon dioxide emissions overall, it has also changed local pollution levels at hundreds of areas around the country. In particular, the burning of coal creates particulate matter and ozone in the lower atmosphere, often experienced as smog, which can affect humans, plants, and regional climate. These pollutants, aerosols, ozone, and other compounds from coal burning can wreak havoc on human health when inhaled, and also have damaging effect on plant life. They also alter local climate by blocking incoming sunlight. Bernie found that between 2005 and 2016, the shutdown of coal-fired units saved an estimated 26,610 lives and 570 million bushels of corn, soybeans, and wheat in their immediate vicinities. The inverse calculation, estimating the damages caused by coal plants left in operation over that same period, suggested they contributed to 329,400 premature deaths and the loss of over 10 billion bushels of crops, roughly equivalent to half a year's typical production in the U.S. The unique contribution of this study is its scope and ability to connect discrete technology changes, like an electric power unit being shut down, to local health, agriculture, and regional climate impacts. We hear a lot about the overall greenhouse gas and economic impacts of the transition the U.S. has undergone in shifting from coal towards natural gas, but the smaller scale decisions that make up this larger trend have really important local consequences. The analysis provides a framework for communities to more thoroughly and accurately assess the costs and benefits of local investments in energy infrastructure. Bernie added that although there are considerable benefits of decommissioning older coal-fired units, the newer natural gas units are not entirely benign. Natural gas units are associated with increased pollution levels, although different than the pollutant mix from coal-fired units, and more research is required to fully understand their impacts. Okay, switching gears. Next up, an opinion piece. This is from Stat News. Why black doctors are like me are leaving faculty positions in academic medical centers. A decade ago, the Department of Health and Human Services made to achieve health equity, eliminate disparities, improve the health of all groups, one of its goals for the Healthy People 2020, it didn't come close. Black Americans continue to experience some of the worst health outcomes of any racial group. Black men have the shortest life expectancies. Black women have the highest maternal mortality rates. Black babies have the highest infant mortality rates. Diversifying the healthcare workforce to reflect patient populations is one solution. But that is a tall order when healthcare environments can be unwelcoming and discriminatory to black healthcare providers. While I write from the physician perspective, similar issues are relevant in nursing and other healthcare-related professions. In 2003, the Institute of Medicine's landmark report, Unequal Treatment, Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare, described the need to increase the proportion of minorities in the healthcare workforce to address healthcare disparities. At the time, 3.3% of U.S. physicians were black, while black people represented 13% of U.S. residents. Nearly two decades later, we haven't come that far. Only 6% of physicians are black, while black people still represent 13% of the population. Academic medical centers are where medical students learn to become physicians, and faculty members engage in cutting-edge education, research, and clinical care. But these centers are not all upholding their commitment to maintain diverse, equitable, and inclusive environments for black students and faculty. There are many reasons for this. Black faculty members have cited lack of mentorship and sponsorship, barriers to promotion and advancement, and lack of supportive and sometimes hostile work environments as factors in their attrition from academic medical centers. In addition to the typical obligations of academic faculty, they are often expected or told to execute, quote, diversity efforts, such as chairing diversity committees, mentoring minority trainees, and the like, and then are rarely recognized or compensated for this invaluable work. I find it ironic that black faculty members are unfairly tasked with the complex and overwhelming chore of remedying the structural outcomes of centuries of institutionalized racism that we did not create in the first place. Last month, I made the difficult decision to leave my faculty position at an academic medical center after more than 9 years there because of a toxic and oppressive work environment that instilled in me fear of retaliation for being vocal about racism and sexism within the institution. I never thought I would leave. My presence and work was significant to my patients, students, and colleagues, but I could no longer stand the lack of mentorship, promotion, denial, and work environments embedded in racism and sexism. I also realized it was imperative for me to speak truth to power and that I could have a larger impact through carving a path of my own by forming a company to equip healthcare organizations with the tools to support a diverse workforce and to provide equitable care to each and every patient. It's a shame that I and many of my black colleagues are leaving academic medicine. We would have ultimately cared for more black patients, taught and mentored more black trainees, and performed more critical research to eradicate health inequities. Black medical students also face considerable challenges. Studies have shown that they report social isolation as well as experience of racism perpetuated by both peers and faculty members. A recent study demonstrated racial bias in how medical school faculty members describe black students in evaluations compared to non-black students. Another study confirmed that the selection process to the prestigious Alpha Omega Alpha Honor Society, which can play a significant factor in medical students' future professional success, was embedded with bias, severely disadvantaging minority students. The lack of black faculty results in fewer potential mentors and role models for black students and contributes to a leaky pipeline for minority trainees. I've personally seen the impact of my own presence as a black faculty member. I vividly recall that after giving a lecture 4 months into the school year, a black female first-year medical student eagerly waited after the class to tell me how proud she was that I was her first and only black lecturer. Even the physical environments of academic medical centers can convey exclusionary messages to students and faculty members. For more than a century, the hallways and auditoria of many such centers have displayed portraits of white men who were accepted in medical schools under racist admission practices, and even some who participated in and profited from slavery, colonization, and the oppression of black people. Students at Yale School of Medicine have described the school's portraiture as, quote, a visual demonstration of the school's values, which they identified as whiteness, elitism, maleness, and power, and noted that the portraits exacerbated feelings of being judged and unwelcome at the institution. Fortunately, some academic medical centers have begun to reconsider how the symbolism of these portraits can influence how minority students and faculty members experience those environments. Last June, Brigham and Women's Hospital, one of Harvard's medical school's teaching hospitals, removed the paintings of former department chairs, almost all of whom were white men, from its main auditorium and dispersed them to other parts of the hospital as part of its broader diversity initiatives to improve the sense of belonging among the hospital's workforce. If academic medical centers and their leaders cannot adequately support black students and promote black faculty, then they will continue to leave. I was not the first to leave such a center, and I will certainly not be the last. These centers, as exemplars of clinical, educational, and research innovation, shoulder the responsibility of ending health inequities and creating environments where black students and faculty members can not only survive, but thrive. Academic medical centers must begin to recognize and rectify the historical and current impact of racism on the healthcare workforce. Their leaders should listen actively and respond accordingly to the concerns of black faculty members and students, adopt an anti-racist philosophy, and through a lens of racial equity, intentionally commit the time, effort, and resources required to dismantle the structural racism and white supremacy embedded in their current institutional cultures. If not, then black Americans could be even worse shape when Healthy People 2030 rolls around. Okay, next up in a related story, this from the Food Politics blog by Marion Nessel. Her weekend reading report, McDonald's in Black America, where we'll look at racism and white supremacy in a broader context in society. So she writes, This is Marcia Chatelain's book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She writes, I did a blurb for this book and was happy to do it. Marcia Chatelain uses the complex interrelationship of black communities with McDonald's to explore the history of American racism and the struggle for civil rights. Franchise is an eye-opener for anyone who cares about why diet-related chronic disease is more prevalent in these communities and what it is really like to be black in America. Here are a few selected excerpts to give you the idea. The contemporary health crisis among black America, like all of our society's most pressing problems, has a history. By unmasking the process of how fast food, quote, became black, we were able to appreciate the difficult decision black America has had to make under the stress of racial trauma, political exclusion, and social alienation. This story is about how capitalism can unify cohorts to serve its interests even as it dissembles communities. Ultimately, history encourages us to be more compassionate toward individuals navigating few choices, and history cautions us to be far more critical of the institutions and structures that have the power to take choices away. To ignore the positive impacts of franchise networks among communities of color that appreciate their contributions would be short-sighted. It is equally short-sighted to ignore the government subsidies, civil rights organization endorsements, limited community resources, and economic desperation that supports the dubious idea that fast food and business as a whole can breathe life into an underdeveloped community. The idea of financially sound black institutions is alluring across the ideological spectrum because it allows white conservatives and liberals alike to claim plausible deniability in their role in supporting systems and politics that maintain racial capitalism. This book is concerned with the reasons that places like Ferguson are more likely to get a fast food restaurant than direct cash aid to the poor, oversight over the police department, or jobs that pay more than $8.60 an hour. This book was reviewed in the New York Times, saying, "Franchise is a serious work of history. History encourages us to be more compassionate towards individuals navigating few choices," Chatelain writes, "and history cautions us to be far more critical of the institutions and structures that have the power to take choices away." Next up, from Science Daily, millions of outdated tests being performed on healthy females 15 to 20 years old. Pelvic examinations and cervical cancer screenings are no longer recommended for most females under age 21 during routine health visits. But a new study has found that millions of young women are unnecessarily undergoing the tests, which can lead to false positive testing, overtreatment, anxiety, and needless costs. The findings suggest that despite professional guidelines and recommendations against routine pelvic exams and pap tests in this age group, there's a critical lag in clinical practice. The estimated cost of these unnecessary exams was approximately $123 million a year. The investigators estimated that of approximately 2.6 million young women who received a pelvic exam during the previous year, more than half, 54.4%, were potentially unnecessary, representing an estimated 1.4 million young people. Okay, sticking with the healthcare theme, this from The Hill. Kansas leaders announced breakthrough bipartisan deal to expand Medicaid. Kansas leaders announced a bipartisan deal to pave the way for Medicaid expansion, a breakthrough after years of fighting over the issue in the state. The deal would expand Medicaid to cover as many 150,000 more people and make Kansas the 37th state to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. The agreement is a sign of the weakening resistance to Medicaid expansion in red states that had been holding out. Voters approved Medicaid expansion in Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska in 2018. Okay, still sticking to the healthcare theme. This from Politico. The most expensive healthcare option of all? Do nothing. The projected multi-trillion dollar cost of Medicare for All has pitted Democratic presidential candidates against each other as they argue about the feasibility of single-payer healthcare. But the reality is the current health system may cost trillions more in the long run and be less effective in saving lives. Spending on Medicare, Medicaid, private health insurance, and out-of-pocket expenses is projected to hit $6 trillion a year and $52 trillion over the next decade. At the same time, the number of people with insurance is dropping and Americans are dying younger. An aging population is driving up Medicare spending, but the rising cost of private insurance is the biggest factor. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation analysis found per capita spending for private insurance grew by nearly 53% over the last decade, or more than double the hike in per capita Medicare spending. The Census Bureau reported in September that the number of Americans without insurance grew by 2 million people since 2017, the first increase in nearly a decade. Even with a healthy economy and low unemployment, more than 27 million people weren't covered at any point last year. That could grow to 35 million by 2029, per the Congressional Budget Office under current law. The number of people enrolling in the Obamacare marketplace has declined, and more people are dropping employer-sponsored insurance due to cost and other concerns. Part of this is President Donald Trump's doing. The administration has slashed efforts to push Obamacare enrollment and rolled back the massive marketing effort that the Obama administration rolled out for years. There are also more than 400,000 additional uninsured children than just 2 years ago, and 4 million in all. And states that haven't expanded Medicaid are seeing the biggest spikes. What we also miss in the debate is the number of people temporarily insured, who miss open enrollment, who are between jobs, who fall through the cracks, said Adam Gaffney, a Harvard Medical School researcher and the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. I see people all the time in my practice in that situation who don't fill prescriptions and experience serious complications. As the cost of healthcare has skyrocketed, insurance companies have squeezed patients, charging higher premiums, deductibles, and co-pays, and creating narrow networks of providers and aggressively billing for out-of-network care. Since 2009, the amount workers have had to pay for health insurance has increased 71%, while wages have only risen 26% over that time. These costs are putting care out of reach for millions. A new Gallup poll found that a full quarter of adults have put off treatment for a serious medical condition due to cost, the highest since Gallup began asking the question 3 decades ago. A full third say they have delayed or deferred some kind of healthcare service over the past year. Another Gallup and West survey found that 34 million people know at least one friend or family member who died over the past 5 years after skipping treatment due to costs. The widespread inability to take needed medication, a government-funded study found last year, is responsible for as much as 10% of hospital admissions. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that medication non-adherence accounts for somewhere between $100 and $300 billion in national health spending every year. The cost of maintaining the status quo is evident not only in dollars, but in human lives. Life expectancy in the United States has declined over the last 3 years, even as other developed countries around the world saw improvements. Though the United States spends nearly twice as much on healthcare as other high-income countries, there's been a stark increase in mortality between the ages of 19 and 64, with drug overdoses, alcohol abuse, suicide, and organ diseases driving that trend. It cuts across race and gender, with the worst effects felt in rural areas.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, next up from AP News. More Americans are dying at home rather than hospitals. For the first time since the early 1900s, more Americans are dying at home rather than in hospitals, a trend that reflects more hospice care and progress toward the kind of end that most people say they want. Deaths in nursing homes have declined, according to a report in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a good thing. Death has become overly medicalized over the last century, and this shows a turn away from that, said the lead author, Dr. Hader Warrick, of the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System. Warrick and Duke University graduate student Sarah Cross use government health statistics on deaths from natural causes rather than accidents or homicides from 2003 through 2017. The portion that occurred in hospitals fell from 40 to 30% over that period, and in nursing homes from 24 to 21%. Deaths in homes rose from 24 to 31%. The rise of home hospice services helped more people spend their last days at home, Warrick said. I'd just like to note with the title there that if you actually add up hospitals and nursing homes, 51% of those people still die in a hospital or a nursing home. But it's good to see that people are being able to die at home rather than in some institution. Okay, we're going to end the show today with hopefully some more good news. A short story from Science Daily, helping patients prep mind and body for surgery pays off. An inexpensive program to help surgery patients get physically and mentally ready for their upcoming operation may help reduce overall costs and get them home faster, according to new research involving hundreds of patients in 21 hospitals across Michigan. Prehabilitation, as it's called, uses the weeks before surgery to encourage patients to move more, eat healthier, cut back on tobacco, breathe deeper, reduce their stress, and focus on their goals for after their operation. It finds that prehab patients across the state left the hospital one day earlier and were more likely to go straight home rather than to a skilled nursing facility, compared with similar patients treated at the same hospital. Total costs for all care up to 3 months after surgery were nearly $3,200 less on average than those who went through prehab. Woohoo! It's nice to see that what we call just taking care of the entire patient is actually cost-effective and has the benefit of providing more health. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's toppun.com. If you'd like to listen to this show again or queue up future shows or listen to a show in the past, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.